is Thursday, April 14th. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. I thank you for listening to RBN and to this program. You are listening to RBN because you can handle the truth. If you have not ordered RBN cards, I highly recommend that you do so. Pass them out to friends and help this network to grow. If you have questions, comments, suggestions, email me at Deanna@Spingola.com. Be sure to check my radio schedule page at Spingola.com to see past and future guests and links to their websites. If you are looking for the website for any guest that has been on or will be on the program, go to the radio schedule page at Spingola.com. This information is also available in the RBN archives, which is available for only $1.33 per month. We will take calls in the second hour of the program when I open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. Let me reiterate my policy with regards to guests who discuss 9/11. Guests should present their views without specifically naming those who disagree with them. A person should be confident enough with their information that they do not need to discredit others in order to have the listeners accept, evaluate, and draw their own conclusions. A guest's ideas should be strong enough to stand on their own without discrediting someone else's views. My guest today has sufficient documentation, charts, tables, pictures, and text that she does not have to resort to criticizing others in the 9/11 community. The evidence stands on its own. Others in the 9/11 community have not always accorded Dr. Wood the same consideration and respect. Many people suspect that certain factions within the intelligence agencies have managed the 9/11 truth movement from the top down since the beginning. I personally believe that people were in position long before that day to stifle any real investigation. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liepart. Her website is drjudywood.com, and Dr. Wood is the author of Where Did the Towers Go? The book site is wheredidthetowersgo.com. Dr. Wood, are you with me? Okay. Dr. Wood is not on yet, but we do have Jerry Liepart, her attorney. Welcome to the program, Mr. Liepart.
Yes, thank you, Deanna. It's good to be on the program. I assume we'll be getting Dr. Wood on momentarily. And in the meantime, if there's a question you might have for me, be happy to address it.
I would really love to have the listeners go to drjudywood.com, and I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about the court case, because that's something that we haven't discussed. We didn't discuss it in detail the last time you were on. But now we have a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay tuned. And we are back, and my guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liepart. And Dr. Wood's website is drjudywood.com, and I would appreciate it if a guest would go to that website, because I would like to refer to some of the pictures and some of the documentation. And as I was talking with Mr. Liepart before the break, I would also like to cover the court case right away. And I have also linked on my radio schedule page the legal documents. So if you just click on that page, you will bring up the legal documents, or just scroll down on the website, Dr. Judy Wood. There's some fabulous pictures, and if you haven't really studied this page, and if you don't have the book yet, and the book, of course, is Where Did the Towers Go? If you don't have the book yet, this page is a very good starting point to learn exactly what happened on 9/11, or at least have a better handle on things than what you might have now. Okay, you filed this lawsuit back in 2007?
Yes.
I think I'll start with just an overview of that legal proceeding, Deanna. And that is, we brought this case under the False Claims Act, and cases brought under that act are commonly referred to as TTAM cases. Basically, the essence of a TTAM case is that it alleges that fraud has been committed on the government, and it is a way in which private citizens who are not themselves affiliated with government can bring an action pointing to the existence of fraud that has taken place that has not been otherwise remedied. Now, as I have said many times, the key to understanding the approach that we took to 9/11 is to identify those military industrial complex companies or entities who had the capacity to carry out the events of 9/11. Does not say that they did it specifically, but it references the capacity that they had that was consistent with what happened. The issue that really brought this to the forefront for Dr. Wood was the recognition that two companies in particular, Science Applications International Corp., SAIC, and Applied Research Associates Incorporated, ARA, both had the technological know-how and capacity to have been involved in 9/11, and they also managed and we asserted controlled the investigation done by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. The report that had as its congressional mandate that of determining what destroyed the World Trade Center complex, but which did no such thing and indeed instead caused to be published a complete sham and fraudulent report on the event. The key element of the fraud was that they curtailed and stopped the investigation of what happened at exactly the point that what happened was about to start. Namely, they curtailed their investigation at the point when the building was to underwent destruction.
Right.
That, was the step too far.
Sure. And you know, television is, according to Stephen Jacobson, who's an expert on mind control, a vehicle of indoctrination and brainwashing. And on that day, Dan Rather said, and I quote, "For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures. We've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down," unquote. And so immediately there were people who, as it was happening, were talking about controlled demolition.
Well, that's right. I mean, Dr. Wood herself has often pointed out, I think her book makes mention of this right at the outset, that in looking at what happened, it is just that what was seen was not a collapse. It was inconsistent with a claim of a smack by a jetliner that two 110-story structures could literally vaporize there in front of our eyes. Based on the claim that that the buildings were undergoing a collapse, it just it defied reason, it defied physics. However, what it did not defy was television's capacity to create an illusion. As the story of 9/11 eventually unfolds, I think we will have to come to grips with the ability of television to create an illusion and to cause people to essentially want to believe things that that are not true, that are not accurate, and that are quite the opposite. They defy reason and defy logic. So that was the basis upon which the case was brought, and it proceeded in three stages, actually four stages if you count the administrative agency action, where Dr. Wood published her findings concerning what destroyed the World Trade Center within NIST itself. That was the preliminary step that actually needed to be taken in order to then be able to bring an action under the False Claims Act. The case proceeded in the United States District Court in New York. Then it was, when it was dismissed there, it was taken up on appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And then finally, an application for writ of certiorari was filed in the U.S. Supreme Court, and the entire process went on for just under 3 years. And to me, the outcome was successful. Now, in cases of that nature, that you might call an activist case, the measure of success, the measure of victory versus defeat, is not always the same as it might be in a case where the issue of getting the verdict in your favor or the decision in your favor is the measure of victory versus defeat. In this particular case, the benefit is that it placed into the public record an enormous amount of information that demonstrated the accuracy of Dr. Wood's claims. And so that information is there, Deanna, as you know, for all to see. You have asked listeners to go to the website and to begin the process of taking a look at it. Now, in so doing, you're going to find, of course, that it is a wealth of information, and it is it will take your listeners, time to go through it, to look at it systematically, or to use various search techniques to single out parts of it that that might be more or less important to them at any, at a particular time. Let me just give you one example of something that I think is useful, and that is that in one segment in the legal presentation, I considered it appropriate to call to the attention of the court the fact that we knew how the court was likely to look at this information, that it would be difficult for the, you know, for the court to assess it on an objective basis, simply because of the enormity of the implications of what the case claimed. And I used as an example the fact that in the military and in the military justice system, they are not allowed to question the accuracy of the common storyline of 9/11. They just simply can't do it. It's against, it would go against military orders. And so what I pointed out was that I had looked and I found no such limitation with respect to private lawyers. That is to say, I was not obliged to accept the common storyline of 9/11 and right, to not bring a case where I was essentially making assertions or advancing assertions that that did just that.
Right.
And I think it was all
we do
the
have to take. We do have to take a 3-minute break. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back, friends. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liepart. Dr. Wood's website is drjudywood.com. She is the author of Where Did the Towers Go? Many of the people who have voiced opposition to Dr. Wood's research have never actually ever seen her book and have not studied the research on her website. Further, Dr. Wood is, to my knowledge, the only person who has filed a lawsuit. And Mr. Liepart was just explaining as a private attorney that he had some benefits that certainly military attorneys did not have. So please continue.
Oh yes, it's and you know the law is of course a structured might even analogize it to a regimented profession. So that one it is difficult to file actions that take on the common wisdom or the commonly accepted version of events, and that especially when they implicate matters that are of extreme importance to public policy. And you know, after all, the essence of 9/11 was to then justify the taking of decisions to invade other countries, you know, based on that pretext. So, in taking on a case like that of Dr. Wood, one has to go into that with the understanding that you're not likely to get a United States court to agree, easily, if at all, with the claims that are being made. One other analogy I can give you there is something that I came across not too long ago that is on the surface entirely unrelated. But during the American Revolutionary era, the Revolutionary War in the 1770s and 1780s, almost all of the lawyers in New York City were obliged to side with the colonial power, that is to say, with England.
Right.
They could not, openly express support for the American Revolution, and in fact, had to take action to thwart it. So when the war was ended with with U.S. Independence. Almost all of the lawyers in New York City got themselves disbarred because they had basically picked the wrong side in a revolutionary war. And the reason why I found out about that is that one of the few who did not side with the British, who was not a Tory, was Aaron Burr, who then went on to bigger and better things, including having a duel with Alexander Hamilton, in which he shot Alexander Hamilton dead. But,
sure. So why did you do this? What caused you to take on this case?
Well, basically, I think it's fair to say I have a background as an activist attorney, and I would also say just very personally that, and I'm reluctant to say this because I do not want there to be any link between 9/11 and the Kennedy assassination, because there isn't, but I can tell you that as a teenager, when Kennedy was assassinated, I had this feeling that I was witness to a coup d'etat, and because of youth, there was not anything that I could do about it. That feeling changed a bit during the Vietnam era, when at a minimum I could go out and join the protest. And with other episodes as my professional life proceeded, there were ways to do something, to make some kind of attempt to be effective in situations where my skill set could be helpful. And so it was with respect to 9/11, when one saw and realized what was being presented, and that it was very much in the nature of a coup d'etat. And when I then came across the work that was then being done by Dr. Wood, I said, "Well, this is something I can pay attention to and not this."
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be right back after a 3-minute break. Welcome back, friends. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Lee Part. Her websites are drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. She is the author of Where Did the Towers Go? It's at least 500 pages of documentation, charts, diagrams, and evidence. And I ask you that important question, Mr. Leapart, because I believe it's very important to look at the motivation behind a person's actions. And so I just was really curious, and I felt that was probably what you would tell me, is that that's how you felt. You felt that her evidence was sufficient to go to court with. Correct.
That was one of the first things I indicated to her. That was namely that the approach that she was taking, the forensic examination approach, did rise to the level of meeting the threshold of what would be considered legally admissible evidence. And so, of course, during the course of the legal proceedings, I did have that claim to rely on. And of course, the defendants in the case that included SAIC and ARA, the entities that that I mentioned earlier, never did solidly or even specifically deny the claim that we were making. As a matter of fact, for those of your listeners who might be psychologically inclined, there were a couple of actually specific incidents in the written record in the case where you were startled because it appeared as though the defendants were actually admitting that Dr. Wood was correct. We had more than one written example where at the very least you could say, they made a mistake. That's a typographical error. They didn't really mean to admit that what Dr. Wood is saying about what happened is true. A third example of that is that as this case was proceeding, many people doubted the existence of directed energy weaponry. And as the case proceeded, I think we become more and more obvious to those who are following the case, including some of the other participants in the case, that such weapons do exist, and that the nature and the scope of them is sufficiently broad such that what Dr. Wood was saying about what happened was in fact accurate. So that's how the legal case shaped up. And looked at from an historical perspective, I'm very pleased to have had a small part in being able to demonstrate that people from our generation, that is, contemporaries with what happened, did figure it out and did take a stand against it. We cannot know how far into the future it will take, or how much time it will take for this information to pierce public consciousness on a large scale, but at a minimum, Deanna, the record will show that Dr. Judy Wood got it right and did so contemporaneously with the event itself.
Right, and no one else in the truth movement has filed a lawsuit.
Say again, Deanna. I didn't hear
no
that.
No one else in the truth movement has filed a lawsuit regarding their claims of how the buildings came down.
Well, not that like you, I know of none that has been filed. Now, that's not to say that there are not some effective advocacy cases going on out there. For example, to my knowledge, there are still a few, perhaps three, of the victims who first declined to accept the settlements from the World Trade Center Compensation Fund, or the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. Most people who were victimized by the event, having either suffered themselves injury or a loved one, a next of kin, perished in the event, accepted the settlement offered by the compensation fund. A relatively small number of them took the matter on to the second layer or level of mediation, and that group received significantly more in compensation. But then there, at last count, there were three cases of individuals who declined to accept the mediation award, and were instead seeking to have their claim litigated in court. Now, sadly, I think the justice system is accurately characterized as seeking to force these individuals to settle rather than to have their cases tried. And for that reason, there just simply has not ever been an accurate, legally based, factually authenticated determination of what happened on 9/11. That simply does not exist.
What was the results of the court case? What did they arrive at? How was this resolved?
In Dr. Wood's case, the case was dismissed on the basis of a strict interpretation of TTAM law and TTAM jurisprudence, where the requirements that must be satisfied to bring a TTAM case are actually quite strict. And the reason for that is that it's understood that there should be a way for private citizens to bring lawsuits on behalf of governmental entities that otherwise you can have episodes of fraud that simply go unremitied, either because there's collusion or because too much political pressure of some kind might be brought to bear, thus leaving the government vulnerable to fraud claims. So on the one hand, there's a recognition that there should be such cases, or that there should be a remedy for fraud on that basis that can be brought by private citizens of what is supposed to be a representational or a representative government. Government represents us. But on the other hand, the counterbalance to that is that it is very difficult to satisfy the technical requirements that must be met in order to be able to bring such lawsuits.
Yeah, so the best thing that happened was that Dr. Wood was able to present the entire case. There are numerous PDF files, numerous papers. The documentation is there for the public to access. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And in addition to that, I think we really did help identify the direction that that the understanding of 9/11 must take. It's not strictly a question of the U.S. government having done this. Rather, this is a situation involving the military-industrial complex, the use of top-secret, sensitive, compartmented information, the ability to hide what is to take place on the basis of employing a lot of people in various technical tasks where the only thing they know is what is on their computer monitor and what their instructions indicate that they are to do.
Sure.
But have no idea what the overall picture is.
Sure.
That means that 9/11 took place.
Right. Okay. If we have some questions regarding the court case, you can call in at 800-313-9443. But let's take a look at the science of this 9/11 issue. And on Dr. Wood's website, drjudywood.com, there is a picture up in the left-hand corner. And the key evidence to me is what it looked like, and there's just no way that that was a collapsed building. I mean, that looked like an explosion. And in fact, right beneath the picture, Dr. Wood has put the new Hiroshima. Would you like to address that for us, Dr. Wood?
Yes. What we saw and what happened on 9/11 was something that we as the public had never seen before. It was an exhibit and a demonstration of a new technology. As I say in my book, we stand at the dawn of an entirely new age. By all evidence, man has in his hands a method of disrupting the molecular basis for matter and the ability very possibly to split the earth in half. The technology demonstrated on 9/11 can indeed split the earth in half, but it can also be used to allow people to live very fruitful, constructive, non-polluting lives through the use of free energy. But we need to choose how we want to use it. And in 1945, we saw a demonstration of a new technology. A few days before that, no one would have imagined that such technology could exist. But once it was demonstrated, people saw that it exists. It existed. Hiroshima. And, you know, it was like, see what kind of toys we have. Don't mess with us.
Right. Right. And that's basically, they bombed, the U.S. government bombed two sites in Japan after the Japanese government had offered to surrender in January. In fact, they'd been trying to surrender for about 4 months through various mediators. And because the U.S. government and the Manhattan Project had manufactured these bombs, they were intent on using them, even though the Japanese government wanted to surrender. So it's very interesting that you make this comparison. And, you know, the pictures, from the pictures that we've all seen of the bombing in Japan, they look similar to me.
It's a technology that destroys things. But
right.
The one in Japan was just destroying everything in a certain region, where this just destroys specific things. It's very careful as to, you know, what it gets and doesn't get. But if you look at the cover of my book, I call that the bubbler. It looks like in Midwest you call a drinking fountain a bubbler.
Right.
Comes up, the way it kind of froths up. That picture, you look at it, that's not a collapse.
No, absolutely not.
And it's not an explosion. It's a building frothing up into powder in midair.
Right.
And if you start looking at the pictures more closely, you'll see chunks of steel flying through the air, turning into dust before they hit the ground. And that is something, you know, pretty extraordinary going on. And for the most naive observer, say, what kind of a technology is that? Why aren't we studying it? If it can do that, it can do good things.
Sure.
And we can use it for good. So let's study it and use it for good.
Sure. And I had a gentleman on this week talking about free energy, but it was more restricted to gasoline and automotive use. But you also have pictures in your book of steel beams actually in the process of turning into dust.
Dustification. A new
right.
process needs a new word to describe it. So use the term dustification, or it was dustified.
Right.
And not, a lot of people mistake it and think I'm saying vaporization because they think that sounds more scientific. But no, vaporization has a specific meaning. It involves heat. This does not involve high heat. This, but the building turned to dust.
Right. And you also have pictures in your book and elsewhere on your website where there's fire adjacent a lot of paper, and yet the paper is not burning, but there's this huge blazing fire, and a lot of other people have indicated that they didn't feel the heat on 9/11, that it was cool, which is kind of extraordinary.
Right. When the dust cloud first rolled out, they said it was initially cooler than ambient temperatures. But then it had some kind of activity that the dust on their skin was eating on their skin, and it felt hot. Felt like it was burning up. Like if you put cold or cool Clorox in your hand, it feels cool. It feels hot because it's dissolving the skin.
Oh.
Or acid or something like that. Acid feels hot even though you stick a thermometer in it and it's, you know, cool temperature.
Sure.
So something feeling hot isn't necessarily that it's heat related. It could be, you know, some other activity. But if you look at the evidence instead of the subjective stuff, you'll see this, you know, glowing pieces of something sitting on paper. If that is glowing because it's hot, then the paper would be burning.
Yes, sure would. We do have to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors with our guest today, Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Leapart. Stay tuned. All righty, we are back. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Leapart. Dr. Wood's websites are drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. And we were talking about the heat that was evident, and yet there was a coolness. And I would like all the listeners to go to your website, drjudywood.com, and there's some photos that I think are really very significant. By the way, how is your book doing?
Fine. Word's getting out about it. It was difficult to get it out because not being with a regular publisher. But word is spreading quite quickly. And it's interesting, so many of the people who buy it come back for more. They're repeat buyers. And there's one fellow that said, well, I got to page 100 and I bought a second book. And I got to page 300 and I bought 10 more.
Wow, that's fabulous.
It's not uncommon. There's quite a few of the 10 and over buyers.
Sure. We do have a caller, Russ, from Iowa. Russ, welcome to the program. You have a question?
Yeah. In regards to what you were talking about with Mr. Liephart, I was curious if he would mind discussing the FARA change that occurred late in the case, which actually changed the amount of actual information that was required by Dr. Wood to go to discovery. And I'd also wonder if Dr. Wood would mind commenting on the various pieces of evidence that all the various other bizarro conspiracy theories just cannot talk about, such as, the cars, some of the newscasts that went on early on, particularly one with Peter Jennings, in which he talked about the lack of debris. So I'll jump off the air and listen to the answers. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you so much, Russ, for calling in. Okay.
Well, I'll go first on that. I think Russ was your listener's name. Thank him for his insightful question about the legal process that came to be involved. And as a lawyer, one of the things that you must do whenever you are proceeding with a case is that you must be on the lookout for changes in the law. It sometimes occurs. And what happened during the processing of Dr. Wood's case is that a change was made in the False Claims Act. We talked specifically about that, or we raised that change in the law during the appeal portion of Dr. Wood's case, that is to say, when the case was pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. One of the rare forms of change in law that can occur is a change that is made retroactive, that is to say, to cover either issues or a time period prior to the enactment date of the law.
Okay, hold that thought. We do have to take a 1 minute break and we'll be right back. Welcome back, friends. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liephart. Dr. Wood's websites are drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. Dr. Wood is the author of Where Did the Towers Go? And Russ from Iowa asked a question, and Mr. Liephart was just answering a question about the retroactive nature when new laws are created that might relate to a particular case. So,
yes, Russ himself mentioned the acronym of the law in question here. The acronym is FERA, F-E-R-A. And that stands for Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act. It came into effect in the middle of 2009, and it had retroactive provisions that dated back to just about a month or two prior to the initiation of Dr. Wood's case, which meant that those changes applied to Dr. Wood's case. Now, I'm not going to try to give a specific overview of FERA. What your listeners can do is if you just Google FERA, F-E-R-A, and then add the words false claim or false claim, you'll get the explanations of FERA that you need. But suffice it to say that under FERA, the requirement for initiating a QI-TAM case successfully were relaxed a little bit. And in particular, that law had the effect of reversing or overturning a U.S. Supreme Court decision that had been handed down about a year earlier, that the defendants in the Wood case had placed a lot of reliance on. This is a decision that is entitled, well, the first words of the case are Allison Injun. So FERA overturned a U.S. Supreme Court decision that had been handed down in a case entitled Allison Injun, which had defined the nature of false claims under the QI-TAM Act in such a highly specific way that almost nothing would be considered a false claim that could be acted upon. Well, the Congress took a look at that case and said, no, this is not at all what we had in mind in enacting the False Claims Act in the first place. So the FERA legislation overturned that decision. And there were other limitations that had either come about as a result of Supreme Court decisions or the way that courts were interpreting the False Claims Act that FERA overturned. So when you had that combination, a new law made retroactive to a date that encompassed Dr. Wood's case, and when you had the circumstance that the defendants in her case had relied heavily on the case that had been overturned, namely Allison Injun, why, when that happened, you know, we had to pinch ourselves literally. So, you know, this is unusual. It's unusual for a law to change while your case is actually pending. And then it is even more unusual for that law to change on a retroactive basis.
Interesting. Okay, we do have to take a 3-minute break. We'll be right back with Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liebhardt. Stay tuned. And welcome back. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liebhardt. Dr. Wood's website is drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. Okay, let's have Dr. Wood answer the other questions that Russ asked. Jerry, were you done?
Yes. Let me just quickly conclude that part by indicating what happened. We actually brought the change in that law to the attention of the appellate court, and the appellate court did acknowledge that there had been a change in the law, but then in a part of their decision that we found is
curiously worded, they elected not to apply the changes that had been made, even though they were made on a retroactive basis. Now, needless to say, our next step in that process was to, that was the, essentially the basis upon which we asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case. At that point, we thought that we actually had a legal argument that really sort of transcended the ordinary basis upon which appeals in the contempt world are made. We thought we had something that really went well above and beyond what would have been legally necessary in order to actually get the court to you know, to agree with us. But alas, that did not happen.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you so much. Dr. Wood, could you address the questions that Russ asked?
Yes. First, I'd like to just reemphasize that statement that in the written decision, the judges acknowledged that the law applied to this case, but they were ignoring that law in order to dismiss the case.
Amazing.
It was bizarre. So a lot of folks say, oh, it was thrown out of court, but the travesty is that the legal system, you know, has
it's
problems.
Broken. It's broken,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. But the honesty is, it was really appalling, that amazing, that the judges would actually state that in their written decision.
Kind of blatant, actually, that they would admit that they had that much power, and it didn't matter whether it was against the law or opposed the law at all.
I think it was an act of respect of many, is how I took it, that they were acknowledging that I was correct, but their hands were tied.
Right.
That was my interpretation of it. And as I stated in my book, in a footnote of my preface, I didn't want the book to be about the legal case, and so that's why it's in the footnote, where I stated that, you know, here this case presents a dilemma for the courts as it involves someone's classified technology, no matter whose classified technology it is. A civil case involving classified technology cannot be held behind closed doors without publicly acknowledging that fact.
Wow, yeah.
Perhaps this is why, you know, they respectfully acknowledge the law applied to this case.
Right.
And they said, quote, for the ease of, and writing their decision to dismiss the case, they were ignoring the law.
Wow, amazing.
because that's
not exactly the way that I would put it, you know, as a lawyer. In a position to, you know, to criticize the court specifically, you know, for what they did, but what I am, I think, clear in saying is that we disagreed, of course, with the court's decision, particularly as Dr. Hood has pointed out, that there was an acknowledgement in the court's decision of the change in the law that we have called attention to. So the outcome was not as we would have wanted it to be, of course, but
it was beneficial.
We presented to the court a very compelling case.
Great. Okay. Dr. Wood, could you address Russ's question?
It's like, where do you begin? Starting with the biggest issues, where did the buildings go? And actually, the origin of the name of this book was partly a question I was asking, but also a question that the newscasters on that day and the day after, we're asking. You know,
right,
where's,
and
where's
they
the
did
building?
That. They did that. They said, well, what happened? Where is it?
Yeah, they wondered, how could it go away, and then why is all this paper left?
Yes.
And they also, if I might just interject very briefly, there were indications in the news reporting at the time that, well, of course, there will be an investigation and a determination of what happened, and that's when we will find out what caused the buildings to disappear. But unfortunately, none of the officially sanctioned investigatory process did any such thing, and the only investigation that you'll find published at governmental website and or in the court system would be the determination of where those buildings went, done by Dr. Wood.
Interesting. Okay, Dr. Wood, continue.
Well, so the buildings, you know, it's not, where'd they go? There's lacking debris, and there's this an abundance of dust. The buildings were turned to dust. They didn't burn up, and they didn't slam down. I was criticized tremendously early on for saying the buildings didn't collapse. They didn't. If they collapse, then you get a seismic boom, a thud. Things fall down, they go boom. And the seismic signal was way too low for the amount of material that supposedly smashed to the ground. Well, was all the seismic recorders messed up that day? Well, let's look. We have this. The buildings were built in the Hudson River with a dike kind of around the base of the buildings. The base is built 70 feet below the water table. And so there's this bathtub or slurry wall that's built around to keep the Hudson River out of that basement region. So the building sits on bedrock 70 feet below sea level. If anything happened to those walls, you'd have flooded all of southern Manhattan. And southern Manhattan wasn't flooded. So he crashed down two 500,000-ton buildings onto this dike, and it doesn't break. It doesn't, you know, there isn't a catastrophe. But then a couple of days afterwards, when they brought in earth-moving equipment, that is what started damaging the bathtub. Earth-moving equipment damaged the bathtub wall, but two 500,000-ton buildings. So,
right, that's an interesting thing.
So it appears that 500,000-ton buildings did not slam to the ground, which is consistent with what the seismographs recorded, as well as Building 7. So we have a lack of seismographic evidence, a lack of debris, the bathtub still being intact. So
it's
all consistent. And then there's the issue of toasted cars and flip cars. What I mean by toasted is they're toast, they're history. Something messed them up, and they're beyond repair.
And you do have pictures right on your website, drjudywood.com, and if you just scroll down, you will see these cars. And some of them are very, very,
weird.
Very interesting. Yes. Please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's okay. And they're as far away as a half mile away over underneath FDR Drive. But the way in which they're messed up is pretty amazing. It looks like they totally burned up, but then an abrupt line between the front door and the back door, and the back door is in pristine condition like it just had a new wax job. And
right.
Including this one spot on this one door that around it is toasted looking, but that spot is still crisp, clean. Fire doesn't do that. Fire doesn't abruptly stop. Like one nanometer over, it's in pristine condition. One nanometer to the other side, it's toast.
Right. And the wheels on the cars, too. Some of them are totally burned and melted. When in this one car, the back tire is... looks great. It looks fine.
Yeah, still fully inflated.
Yeah.
there's this weird pattern that you wouldn't see with normal, you know, kind of car fires. And then there's what I call the toasted car lot. That's a good distance diagonally across from the World Trade Center complex, but still quite a distance away, with a sea of paper in between, and paper that did not burn. Yet, yet spontaneous combustion throughout this parking lot.
Interesting. Okay, we do have to take a 3-minute break. We'll be right back with Dr. Judy Wood. Alrighty, we are back, and my guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Leapheart. And we are looking at Dr. Wood's website, which is drjudywood.com. And we were talking about cars. And, you know, as we were going to break, I thought, you know, you don't see those kinds of incidences. You don't see cars like that being destroyed when they have actually demolished other buildings, correct? I mean, you don't have a whole bunch of cars in the neighborhood just kind of get toasted, as you say.
Yeah, and spontaneous combustion.
Right. Interesting.
They may have something land on top of them, but sorry, I didn't unplug my phone. but let's see if I can. No, I can't reach the thing from here. Anyway, yeah, they may have stuff land on top of them, but they don't go into spontaneous combustion. And it's strange that you'd have the front end, you know, burning up or
right.
whatnot without the gas tank exploding. So you have a fuel line that goes to the front of the car.
Right.
Why doesn't, you know, that ignite the fuel to explode?
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, often my detractors accuse me of speculation. And they, in the same sentence, they also criticize me for showing only evidence.
It's yeah, just why, kind of strange. Why are you showing all of this evidence? Don't you know what the official story is? Come on, girl.
You have to start out with the evidence. You know, then they want some kind of an answer, some trendy term that they can just grab onto.
Sure.
And I specifically stay away from trendy terms and stay away from any kind of name technology because something of this, they can destroy things with this magnitude. You can be sure it's not in the public domain.
Sure.
So why, you know, go for a name for it? But also, once you name something, you pull a veil of mystery over it because people stop looking at what it can do.
Sure.
But if you can describe what it can do and, you know, very consistently and then reproduce what it can do, you pretty well understand it.
Sure.
Doesn't matter what name you put to it. And so that is what I've done is list all of the various characteristics, and I give them unusual names, names you can remember, but not like characteristic number 34965.
Sure, sure.
You can't remember that. Stuff like fuzzballs, fuzzy blobs. And in my book, I have a glossary. But that
right.
is a way of, it's sort of like a double-blind study. You know, it's the same kind of scientific method of,
sure.
of keeping from biasing your observations.
Sure. Well, you're using words, too, that the public can relate to.
Correct. And that, you know, I can relate to that if you don't know what something is, if you don't know the phenomena, don't use the name of a known phenomena to
right.
describe unknown. For example, fumes I use. That's generic. If you said smoke, then you're assuming the cause to be fire.
Right.
Before you've established that.
Sure. Sure. We do have some other callers on the line.
Great.
Why don't we take Shelley in Texas? Shelley, welcome to the program.
Hello, Deanna and Dr. Wood. And I'm so sorry I don't have the name of the attorney in front of me. But
Leapheart.
Hello. Okay,
Leapheart.
Hello, this has been just fascinating. And Dr. Wood, I am a skeptic, but I will definitely be buying your book. I just absolutely fascinating. I have a question for you. You've examined, it seems quite thoroughly, the forensic, physical forensic evidence. Have you also examined the medical forensic evidence? Many years ago, I haven't even thought about it. Well, I've thought about it because it's so upsetting to me that more pathologists have not studied it, but I searched for accidental deaths to victims of controlled demolition, and I basically came up with a zilch. But I wanted to compare the scant findings of, I'm sorry, this is kind of gruesome, but they were body parts, 3,000 dead bodies, and there was basically nothing. Did the remains of the fragmented body parts fit at all with your theory? They did seem to be dustified. And thank you both. Dan, I keep calling you guys whenever there's anyone on with you. I'll say goodbye.
It's one of my pet peeves, but I'll forget
I
you.
Know. I'm so sorry. It's a term of endearment. Well, thank you very much, very distinguished guests, and Deanna. All right.
Thank you.
And if you could address that, okay? And I know there are other callers, so I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Shelley.
Thank you. Well, first of all, this isn't a theory. I just look at empirical evidence. As I say, empirical evidence is the truth that theories must mimic. And if you just focus on empirical evidence, it'll speak to you. It'll tell you exactly what happened. If you don't know what happened, just keep listening to the evidence until you do, because it always speaks the truth. And so looking at the evidence, what we found was in partly what I call the buzz balls. You see dust that comes, well, you see the steel coming down, and, well, I hear the break, so maybe we should continue after the break.
Right. We will take a 3-minute break, and we'll be right back with our guest today, Dr. Judy Wood, and her attorney, Jerry Leaphart. Welcome back, friends. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Leaphart. And Dr. Wood's address, her website, is drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. And Shelley, who has a medical background, is interested in what happened to the bodies and do those bodies demonstrate any unusual, you know, features as a result of the fall of the event.
For what bodies there are left. But the point she made is an excellent one, that in controlled demolition, you don't have people dying, especially years later. And what we saw on 9/11 was these big sections of steel falling, but they dissolved into dust. But they turned into dust before hitting the ground. Then the dust landed, and you could see clear blue sky in the background, and then pretty soon the dust starts rising up. Fine dust could not settle out of the air that quickly. Coarse dust landed and then became fine dust. In other words, it was breaking down and continued breaking down. Coarse dust lands, then it starts rising when it becomes fine enough. And then we have measurements of the air quality. This is what the first responders were breathing in, this very fine dust. And I've got some photos of it in my book where it's down on the scale of the size of DNA. Much a fraction of the size of a human red blood cell. In other words, when first responders inhaled this, it went right through their dust mask and right into their bloodstream.
And what? How did that affect them?
We have all sorts of strange cancers, and a lot of people have died subsequent to working with the cleanup and inhaling this.
And were any body parts discovered, like the jumpers?
Well, there's an account that you can make of the approximate number of jumpers, and that seems to be just about the equal to the number of body parts, you know, discrete different people. You know, there could be several parts from one set of DNA, but that is all that's pretty much accounted for. In other words, what was inside the building, that remained inside the building, doesn't seem to have been any recognizable body parts.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay, let's take Frank. He is calling from outside of the country. Frank, welcome to Spingola Speaks.
Gracias. Thank you, Deanna. Dr. Wood, I would like to approach the topic from not the forensic physical nor the forensic medical, but from the psychological standpoint. Have you done any research on why it happened and who did it and what their thinking was? Was it pure terrorism, in which case it was a dismal failure, or was it some sort of political, financial, psychological setup?
Well, I'm a physical scientist, and so I look at it from the point of the physical evidence. And when you're going to solve any crime, you first must begin with what happened. You need to establish what happened before you can establish how it happened, and that before you can establish who did it, and that before why they did it. And there's so much rush to incriminate or point fingers at somebody for doing something before it's even known what got done. But once you know what happened, then you can start figuring out the other much more clearly. A weapon of this kind of destructive capabilities, very limited probabilities to who did this. So, if you start out saying, oh, it was bombs in the building, you're not going to get to the right answer. It's the wrong premise. So that's why it's important to figure out what happened, and that's what I focused on, the forensic study of the evidence. There are some psychological things I do note along the way. For example, peer pressure conformity that occurs, and why necessarily people's memories aren't like tape recorders, which is why the physical evidence is so much more important than what people think they saw. But I mainly stick with the physical evidence.
Okay, so it's your concept, and I congratulate you on your book. I'm in a situation where just getting hold of a copy of the book might not be terribly good for my health. I congratulate you on your book, and I thank you for your opinion. Your concept is that there was some sort of almost a molecular disintegrator used.
It was energy field effects, and
okay.
The result of it was molecular dissociation.
Okay, I'm a very uneducated, ignorant person, and sometimes I get lost in the specifics of the concept, but I do understand it.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Indiana.
Thank you so much,
thanks.
Frank. Okay, go ahead. Did you have
one of the misconceptions that gets passed around a lot out there is that folks envision, ray beams from space. My detractors like to package my work as such, which is incorrect. This is field effects. Energy fields that interfere. And you can think of it like people have a cell phone. I don't have one, but I understand the cell phones have zones where they work and zones where they don't work. So you have to have your cell phone in the right region in order for it to work.
Sure.
This is something like that,
sure.
Where you have this field of one signal, and you need to have another signal in there that interacts with it to create this effect.
Sure. Now, energy isn't an entity. It is. It's hard to explain. But you can see the results of what energy does to other things.
Yes.
Does that make any sense?
Yes. This, like, if you get a piece of glass with a bunch of metal filings on it, and then put a magnet underneath the glass.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can see what the magnetic field is doing to those metal filings.
Right. Okay. All right, we have Jeff in Idaho. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna. I have about three questions for your guest. The first one's for Jerry. Jerry, on the U.S. Constitution, Article 9, the legislative branch limits on Congress. You know, it says no bill of attainder or ex post facto laws shall be passed. And then when you basically go read the first ruling on Calder versus Bull, 3 U.S. 386 from 1798 from Justice Chase, it says, first, every law that makes an action done before the passing of the law and which was innocent when done criminal and punishes such action. Two, every law that aggravates a crime or makes it greater than it was when committed. Three, every law that changes punishment and inflicts a greater punishment than the law annexed to the crime when committed. Four is the one that I would want to ask the question about. It says, every law that alters the legal rules of evidence and receives less or different testimony than the law required at the time of the commission of the offense. And the offense meaning when the people lied, the date that they published the report is the date of the lie of the commission of the offense, in order to convict the offender. Okay. Could you comment on that?
Well, very briefly I can comment upon it. And the starting point for the discussion is that you have mentioned criteria or circumstances applicable to the criminal law. The False Claims Act is not in the nature of a criminal law. You don't, it does not result in the imposition of a criminal penalty, such as a sentence to jail time. So the circumstances that you mentioned just simply do not apply in the area of the False Claims Act, which is in the nature of a civil law rather than a criminal law. So now, you however say something that I think can give rise to, you know, perhaps something that the listeners might want to know about, and that is whether or not what I refer to as a retroactive change in the law, which took place in connection with FARA, the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act of 2009, whether that is the same as or within the meaning of an ex post facto law. And the short answer is that it is not, that there's a distinction between a retroactive change in a civil law and what is constitutionally prohibited in the nature and is in the nature of an ex post facto law. So that's a brief explanation, but I think your question is appropriate under the circumstances to call attention to something that perhaps needed to be clarified.
Great. But perhaps it might be akin to the instructions given to the jury rather than the law under which a crime was committed type of thing.
All right. The basic thing to keep in mind here, without going too far afield of the 9/11 subject, is that you don't want to make something, or it's fundamentally unfair to make something a crime after it has been committed. You know, because that just puts people in a position where, you know, the law can act on an arbitrary basis. But in connection with civil law, that is to say, law that basically issues out requirements for how business might be conducted, for example. You can make, you don't have the same issue of fairness in connection with making changes on the civil law side of the ledger as you do in connection with making something a crime that was not previously a crime, and then accusing people of, you know, of having engaged in that crime before it was made illegal.
Great. Jeff, you had other questions. We're just running out of time, and
right.
Right.
Two quick ones, and I want to get your book, Dr. Woods, but I haven't had a chance yet. Is there? Have you found any evidence of the U2 information, the NASA U2 information, the overflying of the temperatures of the buildings for weeks and weeks after that, or any titrated water underneath the groundwater. And I'll take the information offline.
Titrated water, I think you might be referring to tritium, and
right.
There's quite a bit of information in my book about that tritium. The issue about the flyover temperatures, well, there was one flyover picture, and then it was processed by, I think, USGS. So NASA took the picture, USGS processed it, and then Jet Propulsion Labs reinterpreted it. So anyway, it passed through several different hands. But what I look at, and that's just one set of pictures, but what I look at is physical evidence instead of computer-generated interpretations. And what I see is, you know, this point where they say it's 800 degrees Fahrenheit, I've got a picture of firefighters in knee-deep water at that location.
Right.
So clearly there's something that is being misinterpreted about this. I'm not saying lying at all. It's you could have a weird type of energy field that is registered as heat, but that is not heat.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, let's take Mark in Wisconsin. Mark, you're on the program.
Jane Josh. Yellow.
Yes.
Hello.
Hey,
Mark Youngwood from We Are Jane Josh. Josh, how's it going, everybody?
Hey.
Hello.
Welcome. Welcome to the program. I believe we both watched your video.
Awesome. That's good to hear. Yeah, I think I emailed it to Dr. Wood. And first, I just want to start off by saying thank you for all of your research and your work. Everything that you've done, you know, over the years for 9/11 Truth that a lot of people don't know about. And I'm just glad to hear you, you know, up on air getting this information out. So thanks for everything that you've done thus far.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for in a calm way of asking questions that should be answered.
Yeah, that video was fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. I watched it this morning.
There's another video from another meeting in Peoria that just went up yesterday.
It's awesome.
You'd be quite interested in it because there's a learning curve, but it's how to handle the questions. Deanna, perhaps you might clue the listeners in on what we're talking about.
All right. In fact, I've got it on the website. I've got it on my radio schedule website, a link to Mark's video. And you need to just click on it and see his video. He did a fabulous job. Absolutely fabulous job. So just go to Spingola.com and go to the radio schedule page, go down to today's date, and click on the video. It's the last link right behind Dr. Wood's name.
Great. And maybe later time you could add also the other videos.
I will.
Too.
I will do that.
Yeah. Yeah, Abe did an excellent job as well. I was very impressed at how he handled the situation with Mr. Gage, and I think, you know, again, it seemed like Richard was trying to brush him off and not answer as much as he could, and it was a little disappointing.
It was interesting.
People in the audience to, hear him go, oh, sit down, yada, yada. It's like, he's just trying to discuss information here, and I'm sure some people got it. It was just, a couple people, but... it was great to see him do it, and I think he also did a just absolutely superb job. And it just why are so many people out there not willing to talk about certain things? And we have to get this right if we're going to go to court with it. So I mean, it only makes sense. You have to look at everything because I point out everybody else has been. If we go to court with thermite alone, we really just don't have a case.
Well, yeah, and also things like thermite burns paper, and we saw a lot of paper that wasn't burned, so then you kind of start wondering. But the biggest issue is that I think Mr. Gage...
We're going to a break.
Okay.
You want to hang on, Mark, over the break?
Yeah.
We'll be right back. Well, Welcome back, friends. My guests today are Dr. Judy Wood and her attorney, Jerry Liepart. Dr. Wood's site is drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. And we were talking with Mark in Wisconsin, who made a very, very fascinating video, which is linked on my radio schedule page. Just go to spingola.com and you can click on it and watch it. Did a great job.
Yes, it's so excellent. And it brings up the point that, the 9/11 Commission did not tell us the truth. The NIST did a research, supposedly. They did not bring us the truth. To get to the truth, you need to speak the truth and talk about the truth. And I think there's some folks that feel that the public can't handle the truth, so let's lie to them. Well, then they're no different than NIST or the 9/11 Commission. They're just arguing about which lie is best.
Wow. You nailed it there.
So it's, just speak the truth. They always speak the truth, and you'll get to where you need to find out things. But if you're not speaking the truth, you're not going to find out anything.
Sure. Mark, are you still with us?
Yep. I want to say as well, Deanna, thank you very much for, plugging the video and putting that out there. I'll certainly be doing the same for your work of quite a bit in the future. And thank you for, having Dr. Wood on the program. There aren't, many places that would even put her on the air. So thanks a ton for that as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You're welcome.
And thank you, Mark, for speaking up and looking at the evidence, and I'm thinking, are we 4 years ago? That was evidence that was brought out, but it's been covered up for that long. But thanks to people like you, it's coming out. And in case you didn't realize what my credentials are, a bachelor's degree in structural engineering, a master's degree in engineering mechanics, which is like applied physics, and a PhD in materials engineering science. It was really more engineering mechanics oriented, but my overall aim of my studies is doing forensics analysis of materials and what happens, looking at new materials, designing new materials, studying biological materials to see how nature's designs can be superior, and also using interferometry to study these things. So when I realized interferometry was involved in 9/11, could anyone be better qualified?
Exactly.
It was amazing.
Right.
And
I was going to say, actually, with how you were describing it, it makes perfect sense why, you would have noticed the things that you did in that case.
Exactly. And why your detractors never bring these things out. They kind of refer to you as some sort of a kook who doesn't have any kind of experience to even be dealing with this, which is absolutely not the case. Amazing.
I noticed in the video that Abe had that Richard Gage said, she talks about space beams and space lasers. That is not true. I do not talk about space beams, space lasers.
He said I noticed earlier you, both of you were mentioning something about that, how space rays is the popular detractor statement, which, Richard said that to me when, I didn't mention those words, but he brought them up right away.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know what? We are out of time. Dr. Wood will be back on May 2nd, and I'm sorry to Betty and Bill and Bud that we didn't get to your calls, but thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in today, and thank you, Dr. Judy Wood, for being here, and Jerry Liepart. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having us on.
You're very, very welcome. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk to you tomorrow.